Hello and welcome to the Compliance Week podcast. This is Joe Mott, staff writer for Compliance Week, and today we turn our attention to the world of healthcare compliance, an area that seems to grow more complicated and risk-filled by the day. The U.S. Department of Justice recently pledged to step up its efforts to crack down on healthcare fraud. The Office of Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services is also ramping up its enforcement efforts. On a more helpful note, the American Health Lawyers Association, HHS's Office of Inspector General, and the Healthcare Compliance Association recently collaborated on new guidance for healthcare compliance plans. In our latest podcast, we chat about recent developments in the world of healthcare compliance with Michael Peregrine. He's a partner with the law firm McDermott Will & Emery and advises hospitals, health insurers, and integrated health systems. He also helped launch the firm's new online Healthcare Compliance and Defense Resource Center. We asked Peregrine to highlight what's new and notable in the jointly issued guidance we received recently.
This is an update from a series of publications about 10 years ago, which first really introduced into the healthcare sector the compliance oversight obligations of healthcare boards. So the new 2015 edition of this really drives home to a new generation of healthcare board members that they play a very special and important role in reducing the risk profile of their organizations, especially as it relates to healthcare fraud and abuse. More than anything else, I think that is the greatest benefit of this document.
How can this guidance assist internal auditors, lawyers, and compliance officers that report to their respective boards?
One of the great values of the guidance is that it reminds folks that there are a number of players in the internal review process as it relates to healthcare fraud. My view is that the general counsel always has to be at the top of that list, but it reminds the board that their obligation is to make sure the other component parts, i.e. the compliance officer, the internal auditor, and maybe increasingly the chief risk manager or the chief information officer, depending upon the size of the organization, all have to work together in order to do two things. Number one, make sure the compliance program is working. And number two, to make sure that the reporting to the board on issues with respect to fraud and risk tolerance generally are coordinated and focused. That is a more difficult job than may meet the eye.
Also, how does this collaborative guidance fit within or expand previous guidance?
I think it does two things. It builds again upon the 2003-2004 version that was originally produced by OIG and AHLA, and I think it serves as an exclamation point, a kind of, if you have forgotten about the importance of these issues, because I do believe it's important to consider that there really is an entirely new generation of board members. You have a document coming from the Inspector General that has that imprimatur that says, look, folks, you really need to do this. We at the OIG are depending upon board members to support their fiduciary duty and effect appropriate risk oversight. So I think with the imprimatur of OIG, with the support of all the various other components, it really stands on its own as a document that reflects the perspectives of the various leading players in the healthcare fraud arena.
What practical advice is there for boards?
I think the real practical advice from my perspective is to make sure that they understand, the board understands, that it is their obligation to work with management to coordinate the roles of audit and compliance and legal, and to think about ways in which the organization identifies and reports risks within the organization and then gets those to the board and then holds people accountable for the achievement of compliance goals and objectives. I love the fact that the guidance underscored the increasing use of compliance-based goals as part of a healthcare system's executive incentive program. I thought that was a very good catch, because the more that we can achieve improved compliance programs by tying executive comp to the achievement of specific incentives, I think it's terrific. So those are some of the areas which I think were really helpful to healthcare boards.
What does it say to boards about the needed processes for identifying risks? What are some of those risks?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's basically telling them that healthcare fraud remains an extraordinarily important enforcement focus. And, it's interesting that, you know, this guidance came out in April, and we've just completed a month, the month of June, in which there's been an exceptional extent of healthcare fraud activity and guidance for the governing board. I think that it reminds this, so in that regard, the guidance, when you juxtapose the guidance against these recent developments, you're really reminding the board, yeah, we do have a lot to learn. We do have a lot to monitor. This is perhaps one of the single most important aspects of our oversight role. Lots of money is at stake. Not only is the Department of Justice, the Department of Health and Human Services, both essentially have a dual jurisdiction over there. We need to take this job seriously. And I think in one regard, there's a subtle but yet important reminder that boards need to put the A-team on the compliance committee. They need to put people who are able to identify problems, ask questions, use outside resources effectively. You need to pick the right kind of people to serve on the audit and compliance committee, because there's a lot of action going on at that level.
How does this compliance guidance port to the size of an entity?
Well, you know, I think that and that's one of the areas where it's a little bit tough. The guidance is limited in its ability to focus on, I think, the more complex and challenging issues that you see regarding board oversight, because it's trying to speak to a broad array of industry sectors, to both large and small health systems alike. So it's limited in that respect, and it can't get into some of the more difficult issues that I think the law would say that the larger the organization, the more sophisticated its corporate structure, the more complex its integration of physician practices and things of that nature, we're going to expect more from you. So I think we're the larger health systems are going to need to supplement with advice through their own advisors what else needs to be done to upgrade their compliance programs in terms of coordination between the various different compliance functions. I think, Joe, the need to really carve out clear and reasonable job descriptions for the various different players. You do this, we do this, he'll do that. That's critical. And then I think another thing that the guidance doesn't do quite as detailed as I'd like is speak to the important issue of how can the general counsel coordinate with the compliance officer of their work product. How do they avoid stepping over each other? How do they protect the privilege? How do they make sure that the compliance officer is working within a prescribed area and is not making observations on legal matters for which he or she is not qualified to do so? Those are tough issues, and the guidance, you know, again, understandably, you can only go so far when you're speaking to a broader audience. The larger and more sophisticated healthcare systems know that they'll have to take their compliance oversight up a couple of notches beyond what the guidance says. The guidance, it does restate the OIG's continuing position that they prefer a separation between the general counsel and the compliance officer, and they prefer that the compliance officer does not report to the general counsel. I would note that these are positions that the Department of Justice, in its own principles for the prosecution of corporations, does not insist on. So I think to a certain extent that confuses the issue a lot. I think that what's also missing and what's important is the importance of what I would call horizontal communication between committee for the Audit and Compliance Committee to work with other committees that have jurisdiction for approving transactions, everybody talking to each other. It doesn't speak as much as I would like to in terms of the extent to which the board committee on audit and compliance gets full board access. And I think it doesn't address in detail that probably would have been helpful how the board monitors the connection between compliance and quality of care. That's an issue on which I think a number of boards are seeking for guidance. You can only do so much with the summary document, though, and that's why I think it's still a valuable exercise.
Beyond regulatory oversight, there is shareholder litigation to be concerned about regarding the board's compliance oversight obligations. What red flags could trigger such litigation? How can an entity shield themselves from this risk?
I think you look at it, and from depending on a healthcare provider, who your potential plaintiff is going to be. Is it going to be a shareholder derivative action in which the Caremark and Stone versus Ritter standards are going to be applied, or is it the state attorney general who is looking to protect the assets of a nonprofit corporation from inattentive board conduct? Different standards under different cases. Historically, the risk-based shareholder action have had to prove bad faith, and that's a tough claim to bring. A derivative action based on losses associated with poor compliance efforts by the board. Again, those are harder that we've seen in the Caremark and against Stone and Citigroup cases. A tough pleading burden to overcome. I think it's less so in the nonprofit world, where the Attorney General has greater jurisdictional authority. I think that we're going to see at some point the Attorney General in some states looking at the nonprofit board and saying, gee, you know, we need you to stand down. We need you to give up your seats and move on. You just have failed to really adequately protect the assets of the organization. You really haven't insisted on an effective compliance program. We're not going to zap you for your D&O insurance, but we really need you to move on as part of a settlement that we may have. I think that's something we're seeing. But to answer your question, I think that the boards can address themselves the most by becoming very active in approving certain types of transaction. What are the transactions that are most likely to increase risk to the healthcare organization? What's the risk profile? Is there any legitimate justification for these programs? Boards understanding the business case, understanding the legal analysis, and understanding the risk. I'm not sure they're doing that as much as they should right now. I'm not sure that boards are getting down into the weeds of the risks proposed by individual transactions and the documentation that they need to have it back up. In the case of transactions where fraud and abuse risks are raised, I'd like to see the boards be more aggressive. I think those who would challenge board decisions would zero in on what they would be an inattentiveness to the real risks involved. Excessive reliance on outside advisors, not asking the tough questions. And I think those are the areas where boards can really improve on their risk oversight.
We've been talking to Michael Peregrine, a partner with the law firm McDermott Will & Emery, about recent developments in healthcare compliance. This is Joe Ma, staff writer for Compliance Week. Thank you for listening.